I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
On Commons People this week, Remainers turn on each other in the Commons.
And her bark has been loud, particularly on the Today programme, but her actions have been far less loud.
Yeah. The pay cap. Is it here or has it gone?
So, could the Prime Minister tell us what the position is at midday today?
And Labour is set for yet another row over process.
And we've held ourselves together pretty well since Theresa May called the election, and that's all at risk at this conference.
All of this and more on Commons People. Hello and welcome to Commons People, HuffPost UK's politics podcast with me, Owen Bennett. This week I'm joined by Ned Simons, Paul Waugh and Kate Forrester, and let's crack on to discuss what was a very busy week in Parliament. First of all, Theresa May's controversial Brexit legislation cleared its first parliamentary hurdle this week after a clutch of Labour MPs defied Jeremy Corbyn and all those Tory Remainer MPs back to the government. Yes, just after midnight on Monday, MPs voted by 326-290 to give the EU withdrawal bill its second reading, as Conservatives such as Anna Soubry and Ken Clark decided not to rebel against their own party. However, Corbyn faced rebellion from seven of his own Brexit MPs, including Dennis Skinner. Things got a little heated during the debate between Remain colleagues, but political party rivals, David Lammy and Anna Soubry. Here's a clip.
And her bark has been loud, particularly on the Today programme, but her actions have been far less loud in the days that have followed those contributions. I will give way once more.
Wouldn't the right honourable gentleman like to just take that back?
So the bill went through, guys. We're not surprised about that. But, I mean, we talked last week about how we thought, at what point are these Tory Remainers going to, you know, show their teeth and actually try and change the bill or bring down the bill or whatever? And as David Lammy said in that clip, was saying, you will bark, no bite. And, I mean, Theresa May must be thinking this is easy, this minority government nonsense.
But it might turn out to be at no point they actually do anything. They just keep mouthing off.
Well, they'd argue, obviously, that it's not usual at second reading in parliamentary convention terms. This is early on, too early to have a rebellion on the principle of the bill, which is what second reading is all about. And so the nitty-gritty normally comes at committee stage, which is going to come after the party conference season, in October. What we saw immediately after that vote was this scramble to table all these amendments. So you've got people like Chris Leslie, you've got people like Dominic Grieve for the Tory Remainers, putting down amendments, lots and lots of them, which they think could cause trouble. The question is, will they cause trouble? Or has the government already been rather shrewd and worked out, actually, we're going to have to give a bit of ground on this thing called Henry VIII powers? And actually, at the end of the day, they're factoring it in, they're banking these sort of mini rebellion in, and it may well buy off that rebellion. Let's see.
It's funny because when you look through the amendments, and there are a lot of amendments, one person's put in an awful lot of amendments without seeming anyone to sort of back them, and that's Kerry McCarthy, the Labour MP, I think was former shadow DEFRA.
Yeah.
She's putting in like reams and reams of amendments with no one supporting her. I mean, fair play. I mean, why not? But I don't know.
Backbench MP, you know.
But the way that amendments work is the Speaker, John Bercow, decides which amendments are going to go to the vote. And there's no hard and fast rule of how he does this, but it's generally the ones that he thinks are going to, you know, change the bill particularly, or have got a lot of support. So some of the key, basically when you look through the amendments, the key ones you need to look for really are the ones that Dominic Grieve has tabled, who's a former Attorney General, a Tory MP, and he's got the support most amendments by the likes of Ken Clark, Anna Soubry, Nicky Morgan. So they would say, the Tory Remainers, that this is what we're doing. We're trying to actually, we're not just trying to play sort of political gestures here, we're trying to change the substance of the bill. But I guess that the trick for Theresa May now and the whips is to try and change the bill before it goes to the vote, right? So that they don't want to be defeated.
Yeah, I mean, I think they know, they've accepted that they're not going to get it through without some aspects being quite massively watered down, probably. I mean, I think the idea of it not going through on Monday was just, it sets the government on extremely shaky footing from the outset, doesn't it? So that's in none of the even Tory Remainers' interest, really. So I think, yeah, they're prepared. They're definitely prepared for lots of changes.
And that's why the David Lidington, we talked about him last week, how unusual it was that he should even be winding up this debate. He should be closing for the government. But it worked. It was very effective because he's very mullion. He's a former Remainer. He's very good pals with people like Dominic Grieve. He's on that wing of the Tory party. He made a reasoned case saying, look, I hear what you're saying. We're going to listen. And he mentioned this thing called the triage system, which is basically the roots of this row between some of the Tories and the government over this, is that this bill will give too many powers to ministers to do whatever they like about, not just Brexit, but anything. Now, the government said, well, we'll have this triage system whereby we'll sort out the serious cases from the trivial cases for statutory instruments, pieces of secondary legislation that MPs can vote on. So we'll sort out, we'll have a new system to make sure that really important stuff doesn't just get bypassed in Parliament. Now, the curious thing about that phrase is triage. You know, it suggests that Britain's been hospitalised by Brexit. But I suspect that's where the guts of the Tory rebellion will sort of eventually fade, if they can be convinced by that.
Can I just, one thing about Lidington I thought was interesting in those closing remarks he made was he made a joke about how he was a Remainer. And it struck me about how, like, really infrequently do Remainer Tory ministers actually say that. You never hear Theresa May remind us that she was Remainer. Certainly not. And
she
a lot
barely was.
Yeah, true. But a lot of ones that really were, they very rarely kind of remind us that they were. But I thought Lidington did, and I thought it was quite interesting that he wasn't embarrassed to say, look, I was on the other side, but now
it's true. That's well, what we're at some point maybe Philip Hammond will start doing that. Although to be honest, Philip Hammond doesn't need to say he's a Remainer. It's obvious everything he does.
There was a wonderful moment this week when Philip Hammond appeared before the Economic Affairs Committee in the Lords. I mean, that alone is wonderful. Okay, and former Chancellor Norman Lamont said to him, basically, are the ports, the UK's ports, adequate if they can cope with all these customs changes after Brexit? And Philip Hammond literally laughed. Went, oh my goodness, no. Hilarious. Oh, no,
don't be ridiculous.
No.
If there are mere minutes of extra customs checks, the whole thing will grind to a halt. And I was like, Phil, this is great coffee, but I mean, he really is just acting completely on his own terms now, Hammond, isn't he? He feels that because he wasn't included in the election, went, you know, belly up, so he now feels he's completely vindicated and he can just do and say whatever he likes.
Yeah, and he's unsackable, I think.
Yeah, he's completely unsackable, so he's in a great position. So he's great for Phil, keep it up. It's great, it's great copy for us. Of course, this vote on Brexit wasn't the only important vote this week that Theresa May had to try and navigate through. She won a crunch vote to engineer Tory majorities on key government committees. MPs voted late on Tuesday on a motion by Commons leader Andrea Leadsom, who sought to make sure that where a committee has an odd number of members, the government shall have a majority. Now, this has proven to be hugely controversial. And it seems Mr. Paul Wall was the one who broke the story mere minutes before I was about to. Talk me through it, Paul. Why is this important?
This is important because the engine room of Parliament is the things called standing committees or public bill committees. That's where, away from the main chamber, in all the committee corridors, the real guts of bills are pulled apart or put together. So various bits of legislation, whether it's on Brexit or anything else, will have to go through committee stage, and that's normally a small number of MPs on a committee, up to 20. Now, the DUP don't have the numbers to have people on all these committees because there's lots of them. So the government tried to say, well, actually, let's just give ourselves a majority that we didn't get in the general election. Let's just say the Tories are in a majority on all these committees, because if we're not, everything is going to grind to a halt. That's why it mattered. But I think what was significant about the government did win the vote, and it was a feather in the cap for Andrea Leadsom in many ways, and we can talk later about, actually, in many ways, she's had a good week, despite everything. She's got her way on that Brexit vote on Monday night. It worked on this, on the Committee of Selection, on committees on standing committees. She got her way, thanks to the DUP. And also on Opposition Day debates, she's got her way. We can talk about that too. But I think what was interesting is that this is all about the fact that the government doesn't have a working majority. It's dependent on the DUP. And as a result, what do you do if you haven't got a majority apart from the DUP? You have fewer votes. It's simple. You haven't got a majority, so let's have fewer votes. Let's not have votes that really matter. And so it's a bit like sticks and stones will hurt my bones, can break my bones, but names will never hurt me. And this is the equivalent, which is, you know, votes on legislation will break my bones. But if you call me names in an opposition day debate or in various other things, then that will never hurt me. And that's what this was about, because on legislation, where it matters, standing committees are what matter.
So opposition day debates, I mean, essentially, the government has said they're not going to take part in them anymore.
Yeah, that was the
big... So when the Labour Party have an opposition day debate on something, and they put a motion, and the Speaker says, all those in favour say aye, and goes, aye, all those in favour say no, there's going to be no Tories now saying no.
Exactly.
So it'll just be carries. There'll be no votes.
Yeah.
That's
what happened this week on the NHS pay rise and on tuition fees. Labour had these two big opposition day motions, and they basically, they're used to try and box in the government and MPs and say to Tory MPs, look, you either voted for or against putting up tuition fees. You voted for or against a pay rise for the poor nurses out in the country. Now, the government have said, basically, and they talked to us about this yesterday off the record, that they don't want this anymore. It's just pure stunts, it's pure parliamentary theatre. Why should they buy into it? And so they're going to allow these motions to be carried. It's kind of strange. You can see why they're doing it. They're trying to focus all their efforts on, you know, a lot of the Tory MPs were up late on Monday night. They were very busy on Tuesday. And they're desperately trying to say to the Tory MPs, look, we won't whip you on things other than things that matter. So, you know, we're not going to kill you. And I think that's why you can see why they're doing it. But a lot of traditionalists would say, look, this is just pure contempt for Parliament.
Let's move on to PMQs now, because there was a... It was pretty tedious this week, let's be honest. It wasn't much theatre in it, but there was some good lines from Jeremy Corbyn, and there's him talking about the pay cap being axed.
At the weekend, Mr Speaker, we were told that the public sector pay cap had been dropped. On Monday, the Prime Minister's spokesperson said it would continue as planned. Yesterday, they said the pay cap was over, but later found out that police and prison officers still face a real terms pay cut. So could the Prime Minister tell us what the position is at midday today?
And now here's Theresa May's response to that, and we'll discuss the response to her response afterwards. Here's a clip of that.
Indeed, a calculation suggests that a new police officer in 2010, thanks to progression pay and annual basic salary increases and the increase in the personal allowance that is a tax cut for people, have actually seen an increase in their pay of over £9,000 since 2010, a real terms increase of 32%.
So Theresa May's there comments about the 32% real terms pay increase she basically was accused of telling a downright lie by Callum McLeod, who's the vice chair of the Police Federation, which represents 120,000 rank and file officers. He said, yeah, the fact they've had a 32% pay rise since 2010 is a joke and is in fact a downright lie. So, I mean, is Theresa May just taking now just to... Because we had this before when she misrepresented, if I'm being generous, the Lords Committee on Constitutional Matters, who talked about this bill, the Brexit bill, being fine, and then came out the next day and said, no, we never said that. And now she's saying this. I mean, this is not a good precedent, right?
Yeah, it's a bit weird that, because, you know, she said, new police officers that joined the force in 2010, because of their pay rises they've had and because of the personal allowance changes, that means that this, you know, they've had this pay rise. But that kind of ignores every other measure taken by government. And that's what the Police Federation was so angry about. And it's just not a good look, you know, if you say something. And again, like you say, you get called a liar. It seemed a bit careless.
And it was Ned, HuffPost, who had that downright lie quote first.
And the fact is, why would you, if you're convinced that everyone's getting these massive pay rises, why are you going to scrap the pay?
Why is it needed if they've got like...
Why is it needed? I mean, okay. I mean, how does this? I mean, are Labour playing a smart game on this, or because they're gonna get rid of the pay cap, right? But they're saying that what was offered to, you know, prison officers and the like was below inflation, basically, below cost of living. So they're saying even though they've broken the policy to pay cap, it's still not enough. But does it look a little bit like, oh, you're always gonna want more? Is there a sort of fine political line they've got to pick here?
I think they've played it quite well so far. I think somebody from Corbyn's office said the government have basically admitted that there's a huge problem, but they're completely failing to solve it. So I think if they just carry on kind of pushing along those lines, then it's going to work. I mean, they've got to talk about... I think was there a debate yesterday about nurses' pay, or is this later in the week? And that's obviously going to be a huge issue. The RCN are already, you know, being quite vocal about that. So I think if Labour keeps on pushing and saying, you know, the government is obviously, it's obviously already identified that this is a problem, now what are you going to do about it? They're going to have to cave to pressure in the end, I think.
Yeah, and it comes back to my point, which is that the main weapons oppositions have are words that you can embarrass governments with your rhetoric or what you say in the chamber, but also you can embarrass them with votes. And given that you don't have the opposition day option now, PMQs is the perfect way to say, look, are you really on the side of the workers, or is this just you forced into the inevitable by the voters who are really angry about this 7 years pay freeze for many, many people who they think really should get a proper pay rise, whether it's teachers or nurses or, you know,
and
or
also,
bin men.
I think in PMQs as well, I mean, I don't think Corbyn was necessarily that good in that session of PMQs, but Theresa May tripped herself up with that claim about the 32% that then was attacked after PMQs happened. I think it's the dynamic of PMQs has changed, where they're both quite bad at it, but May just seems to now, like last time, messing up. And she, it wasn't also Corbyn that made her do that. She did it herself.
And she also made some kind of comment about the need to balance fairness to public sector workers with fairness to taxpayers. And then obviously kind of added as an afterthought, obviously some public sector workers are taxpayers. It's like, yes, they are.
And there's also something in which I noticed, that David Cameron used to have this great trick you see to Ed Miliband, and it was always, you know, unemployment down, you know, jobs up.
Yeah.
And all the MPs behind him would go down and up at the right time. And Theresa May sort of half tried to do that, and no one was sure whether to join in, and the MPs didn't know where she was going, and then she sort of ran out of stats, and it was just so poorly choreographed.
And also, most annoyingly, that joke she made about Michael Fabricant, who she said was going on celebrity first dates, and she said, I don't know if you're the celebrity or the first date, which doesn't make sense as a joke. It really wound me up.
Doesn't make sense not even as a joke.
But
the curious thing about the pay cap, and it's worth remembering this, is that the government are trying to get out of a hole here by saying, look, we'll look for evidence, see if there's a problem with recruitment and retention in key areas. And the Treasury are desperate not to spend a lot of money, so they want evidence. But and this all goes through some things called these independent pay review bodies. But it's worth remembering that 3 million public sector workers are not covered by independent pay review bodies. They're there for doctors and nurses, they're there for, you know, teachers, they're there for police, but they're not there for quite large numbers of public sector workers who get missed in this debate. And that's a problem for the government, because what's the evidence they're going to have for recruitment and retention for those? They won't have any sort of forum through which to do it, like a pay body. So they're going to, if they really, really want to call off these strike threats, they're going to have to do an across-the-board pay rise for everyone.
But
how do you justify that as a Conservative?
But the other thing as well is that a lot of these people who work in the public sector are not public sector workers. So, you know, you contract out your cleaning services to a private company. Those cleaners are then not classed as public sector workers, they're classed as private sector workers, but they might be earning terrible money and not had their wages go up at all. So actually, all the people who serve food in hospitals, that kind of thing, so they're taken off the books of public sector workers because they're not paid for by the state directly, but they haven't had the pay, you know, they haven't had the pay rise either probably. And I know it's a slightly separate issue, but those people, when you think about who provides services, those people are all part of it. Let's move on to Labour now, and the row is a brewing about how the next Labour leader is going to be picked. Now, Kate Forrester, who I believe is sitting here, hello Kate, has a good little tale she's going to tell us in a minute. But first, let's listen to Richard Angel, who is the guy in charge of Progress, which is seen as the kind of Blairite group within the Labour Party, although we won't be calling him that. I spoke to him earlier this week about his concerns about this proposed change to the leadership rules to make it much easier for sort of anyone, basically any MP, to stand for leader. Here's a clip of him now.
What seems concerning is the leadership are intent to debate rule change after rule change that will change the Labour Party, that's by the nature of these things is divisive, and we've held ourselves together pretty well since Theresa May called the election, and that's all at risk at this conference.
In the piece you wrote for us, you talked about how the people currently in charge of the Labour Party have had decades standing outside of the party, selling newspapers and that kind of stuff. So surely now they're, you know, in charge of the party, surely they've got every right to say, look, you kept us out for so long, we're in charge now, we've got a manifesto which you said is, you know, really good in places. Surely now's the absolute perfect time to sort of make sure that this kind of system stays and it doesn't go back to a system which they feel wasn't representative of Labour members, Labour voters.
The new establishment have absolutely got the right to try and take control of the Labour Party for their faction and their factional interests, but they can't pretend that that is consequence-free and that it isn't one that's going to get people rightly exercised and having that debate. What's been interesting about the Labour Party since Theresa May put the podium outside Downing Street is how we have come together, how we focused on the policies, how we focused on how we're a better alternative than the Tories. And this just sends that all back.
But isn't it only going to be consequences if people like yourself and the group that you work for push back against it? If you just accept it, if you accept this is the will of the leadership, therefore it should be respected, then there would be no consequences. So really, it's you're the ones that are going to do this.
Well, they're the first movers, aren't they? They get to decide if they want to put something down that's going to make us unnecessarily divide. It doesn't have to be considered by this conference. I do have a strong opinion on it for a different view. I don't think we should move to a situation where you could have 19 candidates in a future leadership election. I don't think we should have candidates that are barely unknown in their own household, let alone in the country or wider parliament. And I do believe in a system of parliamentary democracy where the candidate that we choose to be leader of the Labour Party has got to not just be a kind of voice against the Tories, but able to replace them. And that means they've got to be able to take their colleagues with them. So these are high principles on both sides. But we don't have to be having that row now. They've got the power that they've got under the current rules. They're trying to lock down their faction's interests.
Are you not trying to lock down your faction's interests, though, by keeping this system? Obviously, there's the barrier in place. 15% of MPs have nominated a candidate. So the idea is you get someone from the PLP who's got support of the PLP, which Jeremy Corbyn didn't have, famously. You know, and he just squeaked onto the ballot. So why aren't you trying to lock down your faction's interests? Why are your faction's interests more sacred than theirs?
Well, I don't think trying to win the British public is a factional interest. It is, we need to have a Labour Party that respects the parliamentary rules that we have, and that the reason why it was founded to bring about a form of parliamentary socialism, and that's what we'll be defending at this conference. So I think it's very important principle. In the scheme of things, whether they change the rules this year or next year or whatever seems to me to be a secondary priority. Whether we are able to get a real glove on the Tories, who it seems to me are really coming up against it. They find themselves wanting on the main issue of Brexit, and they don't have the bandwidth to deal with any of the policy issues that aren't Brexit.
So there's Richard Angel there, and hot off the press, Kate Forrester has a great little story here about, talk me through it, Kate, about how this is coming to a real head now, isn't it?
So, there's a lot of motions that are proposed at Labour conference. So basically, they can propose motions for potential rule changes, and they can propose ones that are going to be debated as potential rule changes this year, but they can also propose motions to be talked about next year. So, there's a huge list of motions put forward by CLPs, constituency Labour parties, of ways to basically change the election process for leader and deputy leader. And one of them that's been proposed by 21 different CLPs from across the country is replacing the requirement for candidates to get 15% of the PLP, so that's MPs and MEPs backing them for leader, to get on the ballot. Replace that with a requirement to either get 15% of the PLP or 15% of affiliated unions or 15% of CLPs, constituency Labour parties. Now, this is not likely to get the backing of the party leadership, obviously, but it's very interesting in that it sort of represents the growing support for putting more power in members' hands. So,
That is interesting, because so far the debate has focused on, will they lower it from 15% to 5%? Most people accept that's not going to get support. That's in there as well. There's going to be lots of people pushing it. But what is interesting is whether or not they're going to lower it to 10%, which a lot of people think is where the action is, or whether or not they will widen the franchise, as Kate suggests in these motions, to say, actually, it shouldn't just be up to MPs to have a veto on who becomes their leader, who nominates the leader. It should be up to trade unions. It should be up to party members.
This is 15% of trade unions, affiliated trade unions, right?
Yeah. So basically, Len McCluskey, in theory, could just put himself on the ballot.
surely you have to be an MP.
But
Len McCluskey could, in theory, put someone else on the
ballot. Len McCluskey could put someone on the ballot.
John McDonnell, you're on.
Yeah, and then with no other MPs supporting him.
Yeah,
and he'd win.
Yeah. But there's another even more interesting motion that Kate spotted as well, isn't there?
There is, in terms of
how to widen the democracy within the party.
So,
it's a bad idea, but go on.
There is a proposal for next year, again, to elect the General Secretary of the party, which is a very big deal.
Who to elect the General Secretary?
For the membership to elect the General Secretary.
That's a really big deal. I mean, can you imagine that? Then that would be game, set and match for Jeremy Corbyn and everyone around him. Because basically, you know, well, the way this has happened in the past, let's be honest, let's not be too sort of starry-eyed about it. Various Labour leaders engineer who they want to be their General Secretary by choosing roughly a small shortlist of union leaders, normally former trade union leaders, and then it's hammered out amongst the trade unions like who's going to get it. It's Ian McNicol, who wasn't the first choice for Ed Miliband, but he has certainly proved his mettle in recent years as far as many Labour MPs are concerned. But a lot of the membership don't like Ian McNicol. They think that he sort of excluded a lot of people from the party leadership vote in 2015 and 16, and they think that he's been in charge of some kind of purge of the left. Now, that's why...
What a successful purge has been.
That's why some people around Jeremy Corbyn would like to get rid of Ian McNicol. This would be the perfect vehicle for doing it, because who would be against democracy? It's very hard to argue against democracy, don't forget, within the Labour Party.
This motion also would ensure that there's always a woman on the ballot as well. There's a lot of motions in here to ensure more women get on all the ballots.
Which is interesting. And crucially, more women as deputy leader. Stop. There's one motion from one local party which does follow up on what Len McCluskey was saying this week, that you could have two deputy leaders, not just Tom Watson, but an elected female deputy leader.
Here's my little rant of the week, right?
Oh?
Here we go. So a lot
we should
of people,
have a jingle for this.
Yeah, a lot of people are moaning about the way that Corbyn's trying to consolidate power. Okay, number one, as you said, all leaders try to consolidate power. It's just what you do as a leader, right? So for the people on the right of the party to get annoyed about this, I'm a bit like, yeah, all right then, mate. It's because you're not got the levers of power. But the other side of it, Corbyn, all these years moaning about people trying to consolidate power. Now they've got in there, they're doing exactly the same thing. Their whole operation is just as bad as anything Alistair Campbell ever did. Their whole, you know, dictatorial nature.
But the members driving
it.
I just think, come on, I just think everyone needs to just... You know,
I mean, Ned was there this week.
Yeah, I think
you were at the moderates meeting, weren't you?
Talking of the so-called right of the party. It was very interesting that they had this big event in Parliament, kind of looking forward to Labour conference with kind of Blairites, you know, so-called Blairite MPs.
Were they looking forward to it?
Well, not really, no. And it was interesting that the atmosphere at this event was very sort of basically we've lost. I think in the last 2 years it was sort of fight. You'd have, you know, MPs like Wes Streeting, John Speller, Alison McGovern, all the people in the moderate wing of the party who there was still an argument. It was very clear that their argument was, you know, vote against motions at conference we disagree with. We're not going to win the vote, but vote just to show we're still there. There was a resignation that the left, that the left is in charge now. Yeah. They clearly accepted that. But just, I think, as the left, when the right was in charge, they're saying, but don't go away. We've got to hang around, make sure that motions don't pass unanimously, just so we can show we haven't run away.
And
it was very interesting.
There's a real role reversal. You know, the left used to always be accused by Blairites of pure gesture politics. You know you're not going to win this vote, but so why are you doing it? That's exactly what people on the so-called centrist bit of the party now are saying. Look, we've got to make a stand. We won't win, but we've got to make a stand to show we're here. And that's why I think it just lays bare some of the failures of organisation, unfortunately, for the centrists throughout the country. Because in recent weeks, lots of delegates for local Labour parties have been elected by momentum. Momentum have been driving this. They've been maximising and mobilising the support they've got for the first time properly in local parties. That's why at party conference, when we go next week, you're going to see a massive number of delegates, like a tripling of the number of delegates there. So much so that Labour are already warning us that we're not going to be actually, those members of the media, allowed on the floor of conference. We'll have to be up in the balcony. Now, there may be a story in that, but it just shows just how this is...
To get served at the bars then?
This shows how it's basically back in the hands of the members' conference. And that's when I talk about organisation, the meeting, the moderate meetup that Ned went to this week, it was interesting because it was packed, that meeting. You know, it was more packed than the PLP meeting. I was outside just a few doors down the committee corridor. But that air of resignation follows the fact that they are being outmaneuvered locally. And traditionally, the Blairites have never been good at organising themselves. I mean, Blair, people around Blair were tearing their hair out. When he was in his zenith in from 97 to 2001, he did very little to consolidate his power locally. Gordon Brown, however, has been a master fixer. He knows how organisations work. He knows how to work with unions. But even he, through this group, Labour First, which I don't think they would mind me saying as a sort of Brownite organisation working with the Blairite Progress Group, even together they have been outmanoeuvred by momentum, and that's really why we are where we are.
Ringo Starr's had an opinion.
Ah!
Right?
Oh no.
From Beverly Hills. God.
People say I sound like him.
Say Thomas pulled into the station.
No.
Say Yellow Submarine.
No, it's Thomas Tank Engine.
Yeah. Thomas pulled into the station.
Yeah, a little bit, sort of.
Yellow Submarine would be good though.
Yeah.
I feel this like this is not what Commons people are about.
No. Anyway, he's basically said Brexit, get on with it. He said the people voted. Did you vote? Ringo? Well, I didn't vote, but you know, if I could have voted, I would have voted to leave. Like, you left the country. Yeah, but anyway. So basically, Ringo Starr's had an opinion. Here's some other things celebrities have had opinions about. If it's not true. No, if it's true, Pete forever.
What?
If it's true, Pete forever.
What?
Pete forever. What? If it's not true, Ringo never.
Pete forever? What does that mean?
Do you not remember the chant? When they sat Pete Best and got Ringo Starr, the chant was Pete forever, Ringo never.
Okay.
Yeah, I do remember that, Owen. I was there. Not it's like quite obviously 1962.
It was 62. Right, okay. So, is Tony Hadley... a patron of a refugee ballet dancers organisation.
God, I hate you so much.
Whoa. I'd say yes.
Tony Hadley in 2015.
Is that Ringo Forever?
Pete Forever.
Pete Forever rather than Ringo Never.
Ringo Never is not
so
true.
So Pete Forever is true?
Yeah.
Okay. Pete Forever.
Pete Forever.
I'm going Ringo Never.
It is Ringo Never.
Yes.
Oh, you made it up.
Okay.
So cruel.
Liam Gallagher supporting the Bees campaign, Save the Bees campaign. 2009.
No. I think that's
2009?
Yeah.
Liam, not Noel.
William Gallagher.
I don't think he cares about bees.
No, neither do I.
Bees, the symbol of Manchester.
Oh, true. So, good thinking.
He was smart enough to go for it. So I'm going to say Pete forever.
I think Paul's right, but I said no, so I'll stick with
no. Yeah, I'll stick with no. But
Paul is right for one reasons. He came out in support of a campaign to save the honeybees because he...
loves honey?
Yeah, because he helps in cure sore throat.
Oh, really?
When Oasis are about to form.
Wow.
At the festival before the band split. The bees are vanishing. We've got to save them before they all buzz off. It's important. It's a really worthwhile cause, Liam told the Sun. He added, without them, we're in proper bother.
So before they all buzz off, he actually said that. Yeah, that wasn't the Sun
Liam Gallagher is a smart
man. Writing it.
Leonardo DiCaprio supporting homeless people in Edinburgh.
I'd say yes, Pete forever.
Yeah, Pete forever.
Like, he filmed a film there once.
Probably passed through the festival.
In 2016, he paid a visit to a restaurant which was run by people with homeless backgrounds, and he was served a meal there. George Clooney's also eaten there, so there we are.
Mm.
Cool.
And finally,
thank God,
is Gordon Ramsay patron of a dancing bear sanctuary in Kazakhstan?
No.
No, it's not.
Oh, I really would hope this to be true, but I suspect it's a Ringo never.
After a visit to the country in 2005, he's become aware of the bear's plight.
Shut up. Is he?
You tell me.
I'm going to say Ringo never.
I don't believe it.
Kate, look into my eyes, Kate.
Not around my eyes, into my eyes.
I don't believe you. No.
Go on.
It's not true. It's not true, but there we are. So that was this week's quiz.
Never do that again.
Good.
All the eye contact.
There we are. That was Pete Forever or Ringo Never.
Yeah, well, that's better than last week's.
No, what was last week's?
I can't. It was terrible. I forgot.
No, it wasn't. It was rating the country on things.
Yeah, it was a bit.
Oh, come on. This is nonsense. That was terrible.
Nah, like, I fast-forwarded through it when I listened back.
That was you listened back?
Yeah, just to, you know.
You fast-forwarded?
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Through the quiz. Right.
So it's been a bit lacking this week, innit?
Oh, thanks.
Thanks very much.
Cheers.
Well, next week's Lib Dem conference. Yeah, Ned's going
to
be there. Come on.
Yeah, come on, Ned. Talk to
and that's about energy, isn't it?
Talk to me. Give me five. I mean,
okay, right.
Go on.
It's happening. It's in Bournemouth.
What's going to happen? Where is it? Bournemouth.
Yeah. Right. Lovely.
What's your feelers telling you?
Well, the thing about
the
thing about the Lib Dems is, because they've only got like 13 MPs, it's a bit just what's, you know, they're a bit, it's a bit dry. They've got, to be honest, like I've got not got much to say about them. They're not in like a particularly bad place. They're not a particularly happy place.
How's Dr. Vince getting on though?
Fine, I think.
Is he though?
I mean, in the context of the Lib Dems, yeah. But the fact he was kind of elected leader by default means there's not that much energy behind his leadership. And he's not new. It's Vince Cable. Everyone knows who he is.
Yeah.
People kind of assume maybe he's only going to be there for a couple of years and let Joe Swinson take over closer to the election, even though, of course, he denies that. So they do feel they're in a bit of a holding pattern where they haven't really got much to do. And they obviously talk about Brexit a lot, but now Labour's changed its position on Brexit quite significantly to become way more kind of Remain-y. That's stolen a lot of their thunder as well, because even things like getting on telly, you can book a Labour politician now.
I will say this though about the Lib Dems. Their press office is very good. They're it's always very good. Good. Getting comments out of us about things.
I have funny insight. You want me to say it?
What, just generally?
Just generally.
Let me get a jingle for this. Go on.
Right. The Lib Dem press office, they are very good.
Yep.
They are very, very fond, and Labour are very fond of their own specific phrases in press releases. So, Labour always say, and I promise you'll notice this when I say it, everything is a damning indictment.
Right.
Everything from Labour is a damning indictment of this Tory government, right?
Yeah.
Do you know what the Lib Dems love? A wake-up call. Everything is a wake-up call. This should be a wake-up call. They love alarms. Yeah. Nick Clegg loved Alarm Clock Britain.
That's true.
They're the only party in the country that love alarms.
So they're up really early, sending out lots of press releases.
That's good.
I mean, their press office is great, but it didn't help them that much in the election.
There's so much they could do. But they're good. Okay, so you're gonna report back from...
Yeah, loads of stuff.
You're going to take your little dictaphone down and record?
Yeah,
Glee, go to the Glee Club?
If only if I have to, because it is...
Yes, you have to. It's the worst thing ever. I'm telling you now, if I find out other organisations have been to Glee Club and recorded funny things, I'm going to do things to you, Ned, you won't like.
Stop looking at me.
All right? Oh, no, not That's the eye
too
contact
much eye
again.
Contact.
Yeah.
So you're going to Glee Club. Listeners, listening, next week, Ned is going to tell us what it was like at Lib Dem Glee Club.
Yeah, I'm making
the
up.
The songs are always the
same. No, I want you to record it. No, don't come over and I'm going to...
They're always the same.
Record it. Listen to me.
Anyway,
right.
There is one winner this week, though, on the Lib Dem front, and it's Sarah Olney.
Yes.
Why?
Oh, yeah.
Because Sarah Olney, who's one of Britain's shortest lived MPs in Richmond Park, having won the by-election and getting beaten by Zach Goldsmith, has emerged this week as Vince Cable's chief of staff.
I absolutely loved when they announced that was her job. Yeah. In the press release from the excellent Lib Dem press office, it's described her as by-election winner, Sarah Olney. not general election loser.
I love that.
Winning here.
Yeah.
I saw her in Parliament the other day and I wondered what she was doing knocking about. Yeah. Oh, she's just like the Gavin Barwell of...
Yeah, she is.
Yeah.
But without the...
There you go. She's
down the street.
More smiley.
She's more smiley. But then she did that weird sort of porn thing with Tom Brake.
Oh no!
No, it wasn't. No!
Right, I think I know what you're
Just Google it. Just
Google it. Don't worry.
But not at work.
It wasn't porn. It was just okay. We're gonna leave that there. I'm gonna get a coffee. Right. Okay. See you later, everyone, and we'll see you next week.
See you next week.
Bye.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.